Thank you very much. All right, item four, discussion items. This is our review and report on the growth sub-portfolio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, get seated, pull the microphones towards you so we can all hear you.
Loud and clear?
Excellent. All right. Loud and clear, sounds good.
So this is our annual deep dive into the growth sub-portfolio. We do this for each one of the sub-portfolios over the course of a year. I'm joined today by Brian Rowe. Brian's been with us now for about 3 months, so this is going to be his trial by fire. But we're going to go through this the way we typically do. I'm going to remind you of the function of this portfolio in our broader structure. We're going to talk about the world in which it operates, the global macro environment, and then we'll do a little bit of preview of what's coming up for the next year here. So just as a reminder, the liquidity portfolio pays the benefits. Diversifying portfolio acts as the buffer. This is the big, heavy lift portfolio. This is where we expect the bulk of our returns to come from over a long period of time. It's not just stocks, real estate, higher risk bonds, and the private versions of all of those, so private equity, private credit, infrastructure, and real estate. So this is really just meant to be a highlight of how our long-term assumptions are stacking up with the current reality and where we kind of see some outperformance, underperformance, and highlight for the trustees where we're going to be spending our time. So as we move through this today, I'm going to touch base, or I'm going to start this framing exercise here. I'm going to turn it over to Brian to talk about the macroeconomic environment and outlook. That's always a little bit of some interesting things, but we're going to try and make it tangible and tie it back to the actual portfolio, and then we'll wrap up with what's on the docket for next year. So just as I mentioned, this is the long-term growth portfolio. We wanted to show that when we're putting together strategic asset allocations, we're never perfect in that sense. But if we harken back to 2015, when we did our first asset allocation using this structure, the forecast was for about an 8.8% return. The portfolio has generated an 8% return through July. So I think it's interesting to note that while you had a pandemic, you had interest rate spikes, you had inflation spikes, you had a real estate sell-off. Despite all that, you still came fairly close to those long-term assumptions. So we are in the ballpark of where we need to be, and the diversification has largely worked. And we'll talk about some of the ways that the market is changing today, where it's gone from a U.S.-led story, and we're starting to see that broaden out a bit here. So as we look forward over the next decade, this uses the most recent asset allocation study that Verus conducted for us last year. We see that we have a expected return for the growth portfolio of 8.6% prospectively over the next decade. You'll note a couple things in here that, the numbers for the U.S. equity at 5.9 and 6.2 for large cap and small cap are considerably lower than most of the other asset classes up there, and lower relative to their long-term averages. That's largely driven by the valuations of the U.S. market relative to all other markets here. And so as we move through this exercise, what we want to highlight is there's a lot of assumptions already built into the strategic asset allocation, including some pieces of valuation that cause us to have lower forward expectations. I think the theme you're going to hear from us is that we do see more stresses building in the marketplace, but we haven't seen a breakdown of the trends that we've seen over the past couple of years here. 2022 was a rough year, but 23, 24, and year-to-date are looking fairly strong. We do see more concentration in those Magnificent Seven. We do see more concentration in U.S. tech, kind of in that space particularly. Obviously, the emergence of AI theme and AI CapEx spending has been a dominant piece of the marketplace here. We'll touch on that as well. But I think as we look across the rest of the asset classes, we do see higher expected returns. And it's been interesting that we've been able to make some shifts over the past year within the growth sub-portfolio, most notably adding real estate debt and adding multi-asset credit. And both of those have been put in place recently, and you see the higher expected returns for those folks there. Also with the private markets, as we continue to build that out, that's a long-term build out. So that's a little bit of just the high level piece of it. I'm going to pause there, see if there's any questions about what we want to cover today before I turn over to Brian to cover the macro environment.
I'm not seeing any. I think we're good.
All right. Well, again, as Tim alluded to, and thank you for the introduction, the macroeconomic environment and demand for capital ultimately drive returns for our portfolio. So for the next 5 or 10 minutes, I'd like to touch on those factors and how they affect our return expectations, how they actually affected our portfolio returns, and then how we're positioned. There's plenty of noise on a daily basis, but the long-term drivers are more impactful and better to watch. Where am I going here? So GDP is composed of consumption, investment, government spending, net exports. It's often used as a shorthand for economic growth. Growth requires capital and labor and indicates where a wise allocation of resource should be in demand. So growth is important because it gives rise to investment returns. As this chart illustrates, the GDP for the U.S. has been around 2% for a long-term average. If you include the global GDP, it's been close to 3% on a long-term average. The issue that we kind of see coming around the corner, some economists are warning of a slowdown. So the U.S. may be as slow as 1.3. The global GDP growth may be as slow as 2.6 for the next year. The metric itself can be volatile, and over the last 10 or 15 years, I think, proves that out. But the bottom line is expectations are for it to remain close to its long-term averages. And in the absence of evidence to change, we stay close to target. This next chart picks up where the prior chart ended in 2024 and is trying to capture the degree of consensus or dispersion of the probability of U.S. recessions over the next 12 months. Keep in mind the behavioral biases here of recency and anchoring and the fallibility of expert opinions, but the message for and from the markets is that keep calm and carry on. We can expect, or at least we hope to expect, more of the same, so low recession risk going forward at this point. So this is the outlook going forward, and it's kind of nice that it's so flat and consistent with history, but we don't really expect that to be the case, right? There are going to be some emergencies, some shocks along the way, and the unexpected is probably just around the corner. So with our largest orientation to the U.S. and with more than $30 trillion of an economic activity, I think that's appropriate. We are the most developed economy in the world and deserve significant attention. Many managers are highlighting the possibility of diminished U.S. exceptionalism, as Tim alluded to just a minute ago. And so they argue for increased international and emerging markets exposure. We are already a little more highly tilted in that space relative to our peers. And so to the extent that those international markets, emerging markets do better, we should see that reflected in our portfolio returns. I'm gonna go on. So tariffs have gotten a lot of attention lately. National level policy, of course, influences capital flows in a big way, but it takes a long time for them to rear their heads, and they often do so in unforeseen ways. Those policy statements can make dramatic changes to the, especially those that make dramatic changes to the status quo, can result in some really big shocks to the equity and bond prices that we see. The investment team does not get involved in the buy or sell or timing decisions, trying to shift our style exposure, but we do appreciate how the investment performance is impacted by the environment in which we're trying to generate those returns. So we're thinking about the global interconnectedness here. Where are the winners and losers likely to be? How will those businesses, their earnings, costs of production, frictions like taxes or supply chain changes be impacted? And can capital still flow as freely to the best opportunities? Or will investors maybe seek safety and security of their capital rather than returns? So we're looking at managers to share their views with us. We encourage them to take appropriate risks. And we're reviewing the guardrails in their IMAs, the investment management agreements, to ensure continued participation in the full opportunity set. I think the bottom line here with this chart is we've had a lot of excitement around tariffs. Are we seeing any patterns? Not really just yet. Still early innings. China seems to have missed out, or at least has not participated much in that. There has been some growth coming from our neighbors to the north and south. Mexico and Canada, I think, are picking up some of the opportunity set that comes from that. There's another interesting stat this morning that in 2024, the tariff rates were about 3%. Today, they're at 11%. That's from the International Trade Commission. And so as we see those increased tariffs work their way through the economy, the impact is being realized a little bit in prices, but also I think companies are looking to their labor costs as part of the savings so that the entire amount of that tariff hit is not incurred, passed on to the consumers. So thinking about GDP as or economic growth as one big factor that drives returns, let's think about what the Fed is focused on. They are arguably responsible for setting the world reference point for risk-free rates of return. And their main targets are full employment and price stability. The current unemployment level of roughly 4% has actually historically been seen as full or getting tight in the labor markets. So we've been able to maintain that relatively low level now for decades, despite, of course, some makeup of that, whether it's the 16 to 24-year-old cohort, which is suffering from around 10.5% unemployment today versus 6.5% as a low before the pandemic. But the majority of the workforce is in that 3.4% unemployment range. Now, there's quite a few adjustments going on in the background here, of course, and that, I think, is tilting the Fed toward making cuts. Certainly, we'll find out a little bit later today whether that's a 25 basis point cut or a 50 basis point cut. But at the end of the day, their tools are fairly limited to affect the unemployment rate. I don't think we're going to see a rush of job wanted ads as a result of today's rate cuts.
Question for you.
Fire away.
I think on a related topic. So you hear a lot of discussion about AI replacing jobs, and there are periodic reports of layoffs and you know, headcount reductions. Are we able, is there, and maybe this may be a dumb question, but is there a way to discern or to know what the causative element? In other words, can we identify what's tariff related? You know, when we start talking about tariffs impacting the employment picture and there in layoffs and so on, or, you know, maybe it's reductions in senior management to get more bang for the buck. I don't know. Are we able to discern the cause?
Not at that granular a level. There is anecdotal news reports of certain high-paying jobs, for instance, out of Microsoft, when they lay off a team or various levels of software engineers. The implication is that some of that work is now being done by AI. Much more efficiently, much more cheaply, much more effectively. But at an aggregated level, the cause of terminations or reductions in workforce are not specific to AI or cause.
Okay. Well, we're heading into the fall towards Christmas layoff season, right?
Oh,
I hate
probably
to say it that
yes
way, but it seems like it's an annual event. And I was just wondering if there's any way to discern, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about it, right?
Yeah, I think what we've seen to date has been those stories typically are coming out of the large tech firms, the Microsofts, the Oracles, those sorts of folks. Haven't really seen a trickle-down effect to the rest of the economy yet, and obviously the bulk of U.S. employment is not in tech. That is a relatively small portion of the workforce. If we buy into the thesis that this is a general technology, the AI is a general technology, the way that the computer was a general technology, electricity is a general technology, we would expect that to ripple through, you know, pretty much all services portions of the economy. Haven't seen it yet. I think this is a I think this is the conversation we're going to be coming back to for the next 3 to 5 years. And it's not going to be a single shock to the system. It's going to be, hey, this tool helps us do X, Y, or Z. And then, you know, maybe through attrition, we just don't hire as many people going forward. That's probably the base case right now. But that's speculative at this point.
Thank you.
Good. So the other target that the Fed is focused on is... Oh, fire away, please.
Is it safe to say that on the last slide, number 10?
Yep.
That's a COVID blip?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Other than that, it's... Yeah.
The long-term average remains... The long-term trend remains there.
Yeah, but right.
Yeah. Yeah, I only included 25 years here of unemployment. We can go back to the 1930s and really capture, you know, the gross part of the world. But thankfully, the Fed has been able to avoid largely recessions, which are really difficult on the population, actually a very difficult environment for investment management, but definitely have avoided depressions for more than 100 years. So we hope that trend continues for sure. As I was going through, price stability is the other measure here focused on by the Fed. It has been an issue recently only because it has not been an issue for decades now. The Fed, as I mentioned, and the world central banks have done a great job keeping us in this Goldilocks zone of 5% or less inflation for a phenomenally long time. That low and steady inflationary environment is ideal for investing because that environment supports business planning and capital formation. That leads to sustained growth, and growth needs capital. So we can have a better expectation of what returns we can generate with that. Surprise inflation is what really is worrisome, and we're trying to avoid that. I think the Fed has done a reasonably good job of that. Right now, their concern is the employment picture looks worse than it was based on the adjustments. And the inflation concerns are rising because of the tariffs that have been imposed and realized. So they're in a little bit of a quandary, but it looks like they have room to relax at this point. So thinking about the Treasury curve, we've been able to lift it off of the floor of 0% a few years ago coming out of COVID. And this level at around 4% is actually considered fairly healthy. For those of you who pay attention, there is a third mandate of the Fed, and that is to maintain nominal or moderate long-term interest rates. That's what they've done or been able to do. We're now seeing a bit of a steepening at the long end, so the 20-year, 30-year part of the curve is increasing. That's actually good. We don't want to see an inversion as we did last year in the yellow line there with the short end being higher than the long end. So all that to say, we're in a decent place. We expect continued steepening of this curve, but that would also indicate slightly slower economic growth going forward. So something of a concern, but the Fed is moving in the right direction here. Starting to put this slide together about a month ago, of course, we said, it looks like the job market is strong enough. There's no real reason to reduce. So we left the title Room to Stand Pat instead of Room to Relax. Now it looks like we should have gone with that Room to Relax alternative title there. But we'll find out later today whether it's 25 basis points, which is already baked into expectations for the market. If we get 50 basis points, there's probably going to be another little rally in the equities market. I think the market would reward that little more generous easing, but certainly the 25 basis points is expected. If we got nothing, we would expect the equities market to decline substantially. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's a nice landmine. So there is it's a fair question though as well, because the administration is pressuring, mm-hmm. and there's ample evidence that there is some inflation. Mm-hmm. So that could be an argument against lowering, but the jobs market is really the tilting point at this point.
Okay.
It's the finger on the scale that says, all right, there are actual concerns with the real economy. Main Street jobs are being lost, or at least don't appear to have been gained as we previously were told. And so I think there is some real justification for a cut. You know, there's some indications that the market wants three cuts before the end of the year. And depending on the jobs picture, that might be justified. I was talking with Tim about a book that I recently read called The Lords of Easy Money by Christopher Leonard. And there is evidence that the Fed is actually really good at creating asset price inflation when they're trying to control for consumption price inflation. So there is something to be said about the liquidity that we had in the global financial crisis, quantitative easing, the flood of monetary and fiscal policy that came as a result of COVID, all of that potentially, likely, leading to asset price inflation, which is why we've enjoyed such strong equities markets. There's a slide here later that we'll get into that. But
thank you.
As all of our managers tell us, that's a really good question, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
You told me it's a good question, but no, it's just inquiring minds are just curious what people are really saying, even though no one wants to say it out loud sometimes.
Yep. Well, thanks for putting me on the spot.
Yeah, I think that question was causing a lot of angst about 3 weeks ago. Once the labor market revisions came out, like, oh,
yeah,
well, yeah, we need to do this. So
yeah,
but I mean, I too appreciate the question because it spurred a memory in light of that answer, which is I can recall month after month here talking about quantitative easing and the effect. I can't remember now how many trillion were on the Fed balance sheet at the high watermark of it, but the amount of money sluicing around in the economy chasing stock prices and asset prices was unbelievable. So it seems like that we can agree, I think, I hope, that's not up for debate, right? That policy over time put a boatload of money in the market and drove up asset stock prices values, right? I mean, it's an accepted reality.
It's fact.
It's fact, right?
It's not legend or lore. It actually happened.
Right? It actually happened.
Yep.
Okay.
And so north of $3 trillion made its way onto the Fed balance sheet. As they were trying to reduce some of that liquidity, they hit a point where the balance sheet was about $1.3 trillion, and that started causing liquidity issues at the larger banks. There was what's called the repo repricing issue that was, I think, 2018 or so. Yeah. So anyway, you'll enjoy the book if you get around to it. So, Lords of Easy Money. All right, so there's some fun facts that we can talk about this chart. You know, Europe started cutting their interest rates before we did because they actually were struggling with some stagnant growth back in 2023. They saw signs of disinflation, so getting closer toward their lower target for inflation ahead of the U.S. And the Fed was, and still is, concerned with the inflationary pressure from tariffs. So that is at least a little bit of the explanation behind why Europe is ahead of us now in terms of an easing cycle. Japan is finally able to get their interest rates off the floor, so that's good. That's good news for them, especially. I think that helps Jay Powell and the FOMC kind of find room to relax, right? All right. So, summary slide here is that you know the macro forces are informing the Fed's decisions, and the Fed is setting short-term interest rate that sets the lower bound for risk-free. We are seeing that evidence that I've alluded to of valuations being higher than normal for sure, maybe not yet historic, but concerning. So if you look at price to earnings ratio as a point estimate on today, that's the right-hand chart, it's really high. We've seen it higher in the past. If you think about it from a cyclically adjusted or a 10-year average basis, also called the Shiller PE, it is also at an extremely high level by either metric. So this makes some of the other indices, international developed, emerging markets, small cap, all appear much more reasonably priced. Now, high valuations don't suggest that a crash is imminent, but probabilities are skewed favorably, are not skewed favorably, and the adjustment or the correction is usually pretty painful. Here's just another view of that, thinking in terms of the market cap weighted index, the S&P 500 on the red line. skews upward because the largest companies are the most expensive companies. If you instead allocated your capital on equal weight to all of those companies, you end up with a small cap bias, and those companies seem or are a lot cheaper. So the lesson or the takeaway from this chart is price diverges from value constantly and occasionally in a dramatic fashion like we're seeing today. We believe value is more accurately captured when investors look at the fundamentals, earnings, cash flows, net assets to book value, shareholder returns, the return of dividends and share buybacks. But again, it's no surprise the Magnificent Seven are driving a lot of that. So the question then becomes, okay, if we're paying so much for these earnings, how real are they? Right now it appears the current prices don't seem unwarranted given the strength of earnings over the past few years. It also appears from this chart that companies are consistently able to beat those consensus expectations for earnings. So is there some sandbagging going on here? Are analysts just undershooting on purpose? Or are we in full-blown financial shenanigans mode already? This is the concentration chart that features in about half a dozen manager presentations these days. The level is at record levels now. So at 37, almost 40% of the index in your top 10 companies. The flip side to that coin is these very large companies are also have a very large economic footprint on a fundamental basis. So they have large assets, they have large employment bases, they are spending enormous amounts in CapEx, they have significant profits. These are wide-ranging businesses with incredible rates of innovation, productivity, and utility. So maybe the high prices and concentration is not unwarranted. Those few companies are generating an enormous share of the overall index earnings. What's fascinating to us is that this pattern is playing out in the global markets as well, where the U.S. represents the dominant majority of earnings across the world. So to the challenge of, is this the end of U.S. exceptionalism? I guess I'd point to this chart and say, maybe not yet, but it's good to be diversified. All right, one slide for the little guy. If all the attention is being placed on the mega cap growth names, then what's going on with the small cap companies? They do appear cheap. The question is, do they deserve that cheap price? There's a statistic that 47% of the Russell 2000 companies do not generate profits. That's largely a healthcare sector finger pointing because they often don't have profits. In fact, back in 2023, 40% of the Russell 2000 didn't have profits. 45% last year didn't have profits. So don't want to be Chicken Little about the sky is falling and small caps are not profitable. That seems to be a fairly consistent state of small cap companies, probably where a lot of them have too much debt or not enough earnings, or they're at the beginning of their growth cycle. So there's some opportunities here while everybody is focused on the mega cap growth set. We could skip this if we want, but the interesting story here is, as well as the S&P 500 has done, the international developed markets have done even better, surprisingly well. Part of that is a currency story, right? They have enjoyed currency strength. So for those investors like Cicera, where we are unhedged with our international exposure, we optically and have realized quite a bit better performance. If we had instead hedged that currency exposure, we would have still done a little bit better than the domestic markets, but not that much.
And that's really driven both by the sharp drop there, kind of coincides with the Liberation Day talk of tariffs. But, you couple that with the fact that Europe is actually engaging in both infrastructure and defense spending in a significant way that they haven't done really in the past 35 years or so. That's what's driving a lot of the exuberance in that marketplace on a local basis, and then you couple that with the currency effects, and it's nice to have some international stocks right now.
I see, I did have a question going back to slide 20. So where do we expect small cap companies to be in a lower rate environment?
So the evidence would suggest that all equities will do better in a lower rate environment. To the extent smaller cap companies have a higher proportion of debt, they will benefit from a lower rate environment. In one way, if they have floating rate debt, the debt costs go down immediately. Or if they have actual bonds, they can just refinance to a lower rate environment. So if they maintain the same level of debt with a lower interest rate, they pay less and it's potentially more profitable. Or they bulk up with more debt and try to grow faster.
So just looking at the second chart here, do we kind of expect them to kind of buoy back into the historical average?
I'm sorry, do we expect a reversion to mean?
Yes. Yeah.
Eventually, yes. It's hard to avoid, but what will be the drivers of that?
I think when we talk about the theme here being stresses building in the marketplace that all else equal, we would expect to mean revert. There's a pretty big stress built in the marketplace, that divergence there. You know, in absence of evidence to the contrary, we would expect a mean reversion over kind of a 3 to 5 year time period.
All right, so we've been kind of kicking the dead horse, so to speak, on equity valuations. So do we see the same thing in credit markets? Absolutely. In fact, it's probably a little more exacerbated in credit markets. So this is a chart for investment grade. You see a similar pattern in high yield. Spreads are at near all-time tights, meaning you don't get compensated for taking credit risk today. Or at least the compensation you get is much less than it has historically been. And again, this doesn't presage an immediate or imminent crash in the credit markets, but more likely than not, those spreads will widen at the next opportunity for a shock or the trend reversion. So the other point that I could make here is that CovLite is back. Remember, we heard about this in the mid-20-teens. It's easy for companies to roll debt, to refinance. If there's ever any stress, they go to the markets, and there is such a demand from CLO vehicles, from private credit, that all deals are effectively getting done regardless the credit quality and the outlook for growth there. So it's an area of concern. I think in part we have given some of our credit managers the opportunity to demonstrate their expertise in credit selection and being more flexible with their allocations to different sectors and different loan types.
Yeah, and I just want to reinforce that the shift from high yield to multi-asset credit last year was really done in response to this. We want to make sure that our managers had the flexibility to rotate through. Because things are tight, we want to expand their opportunity sets. The multi-asset credit folks that have been funded recently should be able to weather this storm better. I think also when we talk about this growth of private credit, we need to remember that our private credit program is largely separately managed accounts. So while it's absolutely true that Covenant Light is the dominant theme in private credit, with our separately managed accounts, we're able to dictate covenants on the loans that we're making via our partners there. So we have a good steady return stream. We're not going to have lights out return stream like some folks who are doing the Covenant Lights, but in a reset, in a market reset or a market crisis, we should have quite a bit more protection built in. And, you know, I think back to 2008, and you know, it's like we want as much protection as we can afford built into that portfolio. And I think you know, it is a riskier portion of the marketplace. It behooves us to build more protection in there.
So the last time Marcel was here, we had this conversation about Covenant Light, and so his version of Covenant Light and maybe the market's version or the generally accepted definition, I felt were different. I felt like we, through Stepstone, have a tighter, a shorter rein, if you will, in terms of what we're willing to do in our credit arrangements versus what maybe is happening elsewhere. Is that fair?
That's entirely accurate. I think, you know, when we talk about covenant light, that can take a lot of different forms in this marketplace. And I think a lot of it is coming down to, you know, if there is a quote unquote technical default in within private credit. So a borrower breaches some portion of the covenant agreement. You know, you can restructure it. You can do a liquidity management exercise. There's a lot of flexibility. You don't have to call it a default if you don't want to.
Right.
And just kind of keep that borrower paying something. You are correct, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but within a separately managed account, StepStone is able to dictate the investment guidelines that the manager is using, is able to dictate the types of covenants that are demanded there. And so I think if we look at the marketplace, you know, we look at our portfolio, we're 98.7% covenant, you know, at least one covenant,
right,
if not more. The marketplace is drifting down more in the 80s.
And we try to stay on the top end of the food chain in terms of the debt structure.
We do. And I mean, we look at private credit and say, you know, this should be a low double digit return stream. If this becomes a high teens return stream, we think we're taking too much risk in that space relative to what could happen in a shock scenario there. So it's not the place we want to get overly greedy. It's a highly diversified program. It's got the covenants, and we're still getting low double-digit returns. I'm very happy with that.
Do you think that how close are we to where we were in 2008? With, I mean, it was insane back then. And are we very close to that?
No.
Okay, thank you. it just seemed like that was just...
No, I'm right. Highlighting that as a shock to the system. And so we never know where the next shock is going to come from. It's always hard to speculate. Right now, we look at the valuations in the equity market as being stretched. Some of that has been supported by the Federal Reserve. Some of that's been supported by just general excitement over AI and exuberance around that. But we look through that and we see real earnings that Brian just touched on. This is not 99-2000. These are not speculative companies. These are cash flowing companies trading at high valuations.
Yeah.
This, you know, the underwriting standards that we're seeing from the debt side, you know, are getting lighter, but they're not what we saw in the mortgage crisis of 2008.
All right, this is really just a backward-looking summary slide of actual returns. And the main point is developed markets have enjoyed those 3 years of strong returns despite slowing growth and high but contained inflation. We've also enjoyed that steady unemployment and well-telegraphed rate changes. So from the investment team, we're focused on these longer-term performance and the health of the broad markets rather than individual companies on any given day. The highlight here, I think, is that real estate really struggled, not surprisingly, given the hauntings of global pandemic and higher interest rates. Treasuries have done modestly well, but it's hard to see why they would do much better without a flight to quality, which is likely bad for the rest of the stuff we hold in our portfolio. So we're not really rooting for a strong treasury rally here. We do not advocate chasing the markets or trying to predict the next turn in sentiment. Rather, three things: fundamentals will drive value, supply and demand are seeking equilibrium, and capital will earn its risk-adjusted returns. So this will probably be everybody's favorite slide. Who doesn't love a bubble? AI is the big theme. It is reminiscent, as Tim just said, of the 1990s internet hype. And plenty of our managers are saying, oh, but we're focused on the picks and shovels businesses. They're already generating cash, and now they're just hitching their future to the AI investment boom. Utility companies. Who knew? That's an actual investment. It's a big investment theme right now. What this highlights is the consensus of opinion that we're seeing across our managers, and whenever we see that, we start thinking in terms of herding behavior and rushes for exits, and those are the things that concern us. The other big theme here, of course, is the renaissance of Europe. We alluded to the drivers of that, you know, defense spending, actual infrastructure needs. Their economies seem to be growing. On the flip side, they are always involved in political quagmires and instability. So there are reasons to be concerned with how long this European theme can run, but it's interesting to hear a number of our managers highlighting some of the same themes as well as some of the same companies. All right, so many of the following slides contain data you actually get more frequently, but I hope it's additive to view the longer-term results in terms of the macroeconomic environment we just discussed. So the board just recently approved the asset allocation here back last July. Additional evolution and refinements to the portfolio, we can likely wait, say we onboard Makita and get some of their feedback from that. But I think, you know, we, as mentioned already, kind of the key themes here are investing in real estate credit as opposed to real estate equity to help add some of that stabilized return, rotating away from risk parity and high yield in favor of those multi-asset credit managers who can more nimbly allocate the credit environment as it develops. So over long periods of time, real estate, I think, as I mentioned, was the one that really got hurt. Evolving our portfolio exposure toward that real estate debt and away from the high yield credit. The 3-year column, I think, is going to be interesting when we think about this 1 year forward. So we had a really rough second half of 22 and first half of 23. That's going to fade now into the 5-year annualized figure, and we will add what has been a really strong 25 year to date. So that 3-year figure should look dramatically improved next year. And this is just the more detailed version behind our opening summary slide. Bottom line is superior risk-adjusted returns of 8% versus the 8.8 that was originally forecast for the growth portfolio. In terms of activity over the year, we've touched on all of these. The real estate debt strategy has been funded. We completed the annual liquidity funding. The redemptions of equities back to our target freed up enough capital to fund our multi-asset credit strategies and the intermediate treasury strategy. We anticipate the second real estate strategy here to be funded within the month, and our last multi-asset credit manager, I think, was funded this week. All right, so the summary, what are we looking forward to here? Start with global policy. Because it is such a major driver of returns immediately, geopolitics, policy pronouncements, these have huge immediate influences on markets, but they're noisy sources of information. It's not particularly easy to manage a portfolio or actively position based on these things. So plenty of negatives, maybe some positives. Looking at rates, though, this is a bright green area where while the Fed is required to focus on full employment and price stability for consumption, this is where the historical tendency to create asset inflation has some potentially unintended consequences. So lower rates will benefit our portfolio in the short run. The question is, how does the long run end up? Right now, earnings growth is expected to be in line with long-term averages. It does seem that it's concentrated in a few firms with admittedly huge economic footprints. So on balance, that's a good thing. Equity valuations is probably the highest risk to portfolios today. Mean reversion tendencies are hard to ignore and harder to avoid.
Okay, and so I'll just wrap up with what we're planning for the next upcoming year. The themes here really is going to be make some advances on how we're measuring our risk exposures across the portfolio, and that's we are a couple years into our build-out of the CAISA platform. We're getting to the point where we're getting really good usable data on a lot of asset classes. We got a few outlier pieces of data before we can roll this out on a total fund basis, but we're finding it to be very valuable, and I think a lot of that's going to show up both for the team next year and in terms of what's going to get reported both to the investment committee and to the board. The other theme, obviously, is going to be with the change from Verus to Makita, getting them ramped up over the next year and getting their view on the portfolio. We do continue to implement the multi-asset credit. Brian mentioned we've done the first few rounds of this. We've got about $200 million more that we can deploy to get to target. So that'll be something we take a look at This year, we continue to just watch the marketplace there, talk with a number of firms. Real estate debt, we've made two commitments, one of which is drawn, one of which is going to get drawn in about 2 weeks here. So we'll be have our first two tranches in the place. We'll probably have about another 200 to go there as well. And then lastly, we have the long-term build-out on private equity and real assets. Private credit, we're fairly close to target. That's going to kind of continue to grow organically. Private equity, we're continuing to source new managers there and try to maintain our pacing to get that capital deployed. Real assets infrastructure, we've had better luck of doing some interesting deals at bigger check sizes there recently. And then I think, one of the things we'll want to take a look at when the consultant question is settled is how we proceed on the real estate side, just given the prolonged pain of that segment.
So on the consultant question, and I probably could easily ask you this offline, but what's the state of the transition at this point in terms of planning, outlook, horizon?
Right now, we're going through contract negotiations, still with an expectation that we can get something started in October.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But until there's a contract, I'm a little loath to put it.
I wasn't trying to put you on the spot here. Yeah. I was just trying to get a ballpark idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions of Tim?
Yeah, sorry, I won't take a lot of time here, but I really appreciate how you started off the presentation with a 10-year look back. Trying to take the, I would say, long-term view, but it's not really the long-term view when you're talking about, running the pension, right? I mean, you're thinking, you're always thinking in terms of decades, or you should be. But looking back, I mean, we've got new consultants coming on, you've got a new risk system you're getting insights from, you've got a few new hires on the team. Just this past year has been so much change going on. First of all, I want to start off with a note of appreciation for the stability I think you've brought to the team and the philosophy, the kind of consistency and returns close to forecast don't happen if there isn't a consistent philosophy through that time. And so even in the midst of all this change, there's been, I think, one direction, and that's been great. At the tail end, maybe, of this decade or so, that I think one consistent theme has been FFP, right? And in hindsight, I'm wondering if you've had a chance to kind of consider the success or evaluate the success of that, both in terms of, I guess it's a little bit difficult, when you buy insurance and the house doesn't burn down, you feel like all the money got wasted, right?
But I do that all the time.
Yeah, you rue the check that you wrote. But so one hand, you're calculating the opportunity cost, hopefully, or at least penciling that out somehow. And on the other, you're thinking about, okay, we did, it did give us a certain amount of flexibility and protection, maybe unused or maybe used. And looking back on that decade, and the kind of the big decisions, how would you evaluate that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. I think we go back to what were we trying to accomplish with this structure, and it really was addressing some of the concerns expressed at that point in time about going more into illiquid marketplace and, being able to both lock up capital long-term and have capital short-term. This was a way of doing it. I think so. It's been effective as a tool, as a communication tool. It's certainly we're happy to have that construct in March of 2000 when we had a crisis here. I think if we look back and said in September of 2015, if we were looking forward a decade, would we expected quite how things unfolded? Base case, no. I would not have expected the U.S. market to run that far. I would not have expected emerging markets to lag that much. I would not have expected a global pandemic. And so I think it's a good question. It's a difficult question to answer. And I think if we have to look at this and say, has it delivered on its promises? Liquidity has, absolutely. And that's just kind of in lockstep there. Growth, pretty darn close. we had some problems with real estate and that not delivering in that market segment. And so I think if we take a look at this and say, given the risk level that the board wanted to implement, I think it, you know, it largely has been effective. That's not to say we don't want to iterate. We do want to iterate. We want to refine this over time. And I think that's the conversation we're focused on right now is like, this has accomplished the board's stated goals. How can we make it work even better going forward? And so I guess I'm personally not at a point where I'm saying like, maybe we step away from this. I'm saying, you know, unless the board's stated goals change significantly from where they were, I think this is a good solution and we want to work to improve it.
I'll be interested to hear Makita's thoughts on that as well. You know, that they have a lot of energy in that space and had a lot of exuberance around the strategy. So it'll be interesting to get their take as well in interacting with you on that question.
Yeah, and we've already begun the conversations around what's the appropriate structure of a liquidity program. Is it gross benefits? Is it net benefits? We've had that discussion here with the trustees at last year's asset allocation. I think some of that comes down to, you know, how the quality of your data, the quality of your forecast, and refining that and getting more comfortable there. I think they've got some tools that'll be interested to see get rolled out here. But you know, it is a, it's something I'm looking forward to saying, given these tools, given the changes we've had over the past year, both in staffing and tools and consultant, what can we do to take this forward to the next level? That's my viewpoint right now.
All right. Any other questions?
One question. There's been a push recently to change from quarterly reporting to semi-annual reporting, right, on the public markets. So what's your take on this? Is it, because I think consensus, at least what I read, is it's positive. But on the other hand, it could be a way for companies to hide their, I guess, bad things for longer, and then the volatility could be higher. So, yeah.
Yeah, so from a data junkie like myself and anybody else on the investment team, it's going to be sad if we don't get the quarterly excitement of earnings announcements. But Europe has been in a semi-annual reporting framework for decades. You could argue that's a part of why they have slower growth. I don't know that is really well justified. There is some concern around management, again, with the financial shenanigans that they can play and have now a longer lead time before they get outed. It's hard to say that would actually be the case, but you know, more information is usually better. It's not always more accurate.
But we do try to deploy over a 10 to 30 year cycle. So what happens in the quarter, yes, it matters for, you know, visibility, it matters for trading as a long-term owner. Like, yeah, I like the visibility, but does that quarter has to be taken in the context of what are you doing to capture returns over the next decade or multiple decades? So.
For what it's worth, I think more is better, you know, in terms of frequency and having insight
into that. More transparency is better.
More transparency is better. It got a lot, you know, semi-annual, there's a lot of room for mischief, it would seem to me, without being unduly negative about it. But.
Thank you all for your engagement. I'm open to more questions whenever.
On a going forward basis, on investment vehicles like global strategies, international strategies, the third one escapes me at the moment, emerging markets, what's the status on what kind of direction we're giving with regard to China? Is it an ex-China policy? As recently as a year or so ago, if we had talked ex-China, almost all the consultants said, well, then we can't give you anything that doesn't exist. Now my belief is that there's a lot of those alternatives out there. So have we given any direction, or is there an internal thought as to whether or not we're going to lighten up on the Chinese strategy or perhaps even ignore it for a while?
So the last conversation the board had was maintain the global exposure, including China, in the benchmarks. And in what the managers were allowed to do. The managers had lightened up on China organically. And so I think the last conversation was this was a relatively small part of the portfolio. It's not gonna have a huge impact based upon where positioning was at that point in time. I think going forward, looking at the ex-China benchmarks is gonna be interesting. It just, it's an interesting dichotomy that Chinese marketplace is so huge, but their portion of the global equity market is so small that, you know, when you look at the MSCI ACT, we have that global benchmark, the U.S. is 63-64% of that. China is one. So you just, not a lot of their economy is embedded in there. And so when we take a look at deploying money on a global basis, it's a de minimis part of the global benchmark. Emerging markets is a little bit different story, worth a bigger chunk of that one, although it's been shrinking as India and Malaysia and Indonesia expand there. And so I think it's something we can take a look at revisiting, particularly if the fundamentals around the Chinese marketplace shift. It's been a difficult to do any kind of forecasting there. They've had rough years, they've had great years, it bounces back and forth. At this point in time, that discretion is in the hands of our active managers about how to deploy and how much to deploy into China. But certainly, if that's a discussion the board wants to have in the future, we can bring that up on kind of the research agenda with Nikita.
I just continue to be concerned about being a partner with the CCP, if you will, and also the reliability that we might place on any figures that come out of China. There's just, they cook the books reportedly constantly. And so they'll give you whatever number you're looking for, and doesn't matter, you can't rely on it either way.
I hear you. I think when we look at deploying money outside the United States, you know, the preference is as close as English common law as possible and customs as possible, but we understand that there are places where the risk return trade-off is large enough to kind of overcome that. The other way of doing global investing is to kind of establish a common, here's a rule of law that we'll accept globally, here's a human rights record we'll accept globally. We maintain dialogue with a couple of other investors who are trying to go down that path. You can go to an ex-China benchmark and let the manager make the Chinese call as an active bet that's out of benchmark. There's a number of options there. I think, you know, the Chinese marketplace cooling over the past 3 years and managers rotating out of China has probably meant that that's been a lower priority discussion, but I imagine that'll pick up with any kind of organic growth coming out of the Chinese marketplace.
Anything else for Tim?
Not seeing anything, thank you.
Great. Very interesting, very informative, thank you.